Good morning. It is 11:08 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. I want to thank those of you who saw my Twitter posting that we were experiencing a few technical difficulties. One of the paradigms of radio is that you are on time, and we are usually on time. If you just joined us, my name is Angel Fall. We are broadcasting on the Black Talk Radio Network. My sound engineer is Scotty Reed, who's also founder of the Black Talk Radio Network. Today's show is Cleveland Killings, Call Your Councilman to Change the Death and Destruction. Those of you who've been following me all summer since we began know that I broadcast from Cleveland, Ohio. And Cleveland, Ohio is actually notorious for some, for the Tamir Rice case, for instance, and for having a very high homicide rate. And if you are a listener in another part of the country, because I'm a believer in public health models, you will hear how some of the things that I'm proposing to resolve the issue of morbidity and mortality in the African American male population is applicable to your city. I try to give out resources, and hopefully, if you are listening outside the Midwest region or the Great Lakes region, you will realize that many of these statistics are comparable in large East Coast cities and down south as well. So in today's show, Cleveland Killings, Call Your Councilman to Change Death and Destruction, I want to point out to listeners who are on the web that you can go to 2019 Cleveland, and they actually, which is a television station, they actually have a map of all the homicides recorded as of October 29th, 2019. And that's quite remarkable. As you know, I am trained to do research, and research usually has a lag time. Some of the research that we'll be quoting during the show might be a year or 2 years old, and that's kind of a retrospective analysis. But this is a live map in that every time someone is murdered, they post the name and circumstances and the actual location. So what I'm going to do, before I go on with that part, I want to acknowledge that today is Veterans Day, and my sound engineer, Scotty Reed, is also a veteran. And I want to thank all the veterans who have served. I'm going to start with my family. I am related to an African-American man who served in World War I. I'm also related to an African-American man who got his freedom during George Washington's war. The information about him is a little bit mixed. I'm not sure if he served, but I do know that slaves that were enslaved during the Revolutionary War could petition for freedom based on the fact that the country was changing between being British rule and Minutemen, George Washington's army, the Continental Army. So here are a few statistics. What percentage of soldiers in World War II were Black? Although African Americans constitute approximately 11% of the population aged 18 through 37 at that time, only 0.8% of Army enlistees and 1% of Navy enlistees during the period July 1st, 1944 to June 30th were of that race. Black veterans have fought in the Revolutionary War. Some of you may not know that, especially since we're broadcasting from the East Coast. Black soldiers in the American Revolutionary War have been recorded. If you believe that someone in your family is a descendant of a veteran from the Revolutionary War, George Washington's war, you can, believe it or not, you can still find that on the National Archives. So some of the soldiers that were African Americans in the Revolutionary War, Crispus Attucks, Peter Salem, Salempour, Colonel Ty, Prince Whipple, Thomas Peters, Austin Dabney, Brazilla Lou. I'm reading from Wikipedia, as between 200,000 and 250 soldiers and militia served during the Revolutionary War, that would mean black soldiers were made up approximately 4% of the Patriot numbers. Of the 9,000 black soldiers accounted for, 5,000 were what Wikipedia calls combat declined, meaning that they did not want them to fight. Okay. So notably, the average length of time, I'm sorry, I said declined. 5,000 were combat dedicated troops. As you know, even as late as the Civil War, some of the enlistees, be they on the Confederate side, be they on the federal side, which of course is the United States Army, they were denied weapons, for instance, even though they enlisted. Many slaves who enlisted, be it the Revolutionary War or the Civil War, were very interested in also obtaining freedom because of their service. But again, if you go on the National Archives, they actually keep records of any soldier who could have received a pension. Going back to the Revolutionary War, because it's Veterans Day, if you just tuned in, my name is Angel Fall, and at the top of the show, we're just giving some facts about African-American veterans during the history of various wars. Now we take a look at the escaped slaves. Many of them joined the British Army because the British Army was paying more. Much of this number was seen after Dunmore's proclamation and subsequently the Phillipsburg Proclamation issued by Sir Henry Clinton. Remember, America is under British rule at this time. Though between only 800 and 2,000 slaves reached Dunmore himself, the publication of both proclamations incentivized nearly 100,000 slaves to escape across the American colonies, many lured by the promise of freedom. Christmas Addicks is who I mentioned in the beginning. He was shot dead by British soldiers in the Boston Massacre in 1770, and he is considered a martyr of the Revolutionary War. And if you are curious, it'll be kind of interesting to note that there are black veterans, soldiers, who fought for both the Confederacy and the Union Army. So if you've seen the movie, a couple of movies address it. Glory addresses that. Of course, there's that famous whipping scene with Denzel Washington. But there are African American and Native American soldiers in the Confederate Army. I do say Confederate Army, that's the proper word, but a lot of people say rebel soldiers, for instance. Confederate Army blacks did not serve in the Confederate Army as combat troops. Blacks were not merely not recruited, service was actually forbidden by the Confederacy. Enslaved blacks were sometimes used for camp labor. And so there are, in fact, some who, there are some slaves who came along with their masters for that matter. So we're just giving honor today for black veterans. And I want to honor those close to home that I have a consanguine relationship to. My father is a Korean War veteran. My uncle is a Vietnam veteran, and my grandmother's brother was a World War I veteran. If you just tuned in, it's about 11:15. We had a little bit of a late start, but we are going forward. I want to thank those of you who follow me on Twitter. And today's show, we're looking at the crime in Cleveland, Ohio. The title of today's show on Victim to Victorious is Cleveland Killings, Call Your Councilman to Change the Death and Destruction. We're broadcasting on the Black Talk Radio Network. And one of the things I want to do is to take a look. If you can follow me, go to 2019 Cleveland, Ohio, and you can click Homicide Map. And so in honor of some of the people who've died, I'm just going to give you an idea of their names. But first, I want to give you an overview of what is going on in Cleveland. I am reading from Cleveland 19, that's Cleveland19.com, interactive map homicides that have happened in your neighborhood. And of course, you can join our discussion. I'd love to hear from the audience. Be you a lay person, be you someone who's grieving. We're going to take a look at what people are doing in communities that are hit by gun violence, and maybe Cleveland, Ohio, and Chicago can implement the model that started in Boston, Massachusetts. If you want to join the discussion, 704-802-5056, mute your phone, and then wait for the prompt so that you can join the discussion. 704-802-5056. You can follow me on Twitter at On Air Angel. Reading from the 2019 article, just this month alone, 21 people have been killed in Cleveland. The latest crime included a 16-year-old stabbed in the city's Old Brooklyn neighborhood and in Mount Pleasant. The bodies of four people were found in a house on East 144th Street. Those victims were all shot to death. According to Cleveland police, so far this year, there have been nearly 100 violent deaths in the city. Remember, this article is published on October 29th. At least 79 of those were shootings. 7 people died from blunt force. 4 people were stabbed to death. 2 were caused by arson. 2-year-old Aubrey Stone and 6-year-old Armin Johnson were killed in a fire set on purpose in their Slavic Village home. They are among the youngest victims, who overall range in age is from 1 to 71. Most of the victims, nearly 70%, are Black. City Councilman Bashir Jones is calling on Clevelanders to step up and turn in those responsible. They know, quoting him, "Our community knows the people who are committing these crimes. These are not outsiders. These are not somebody from rural Ohio killing us. These are people who are right in our midst, causing us the most problems," said Jones. 19 News found that most of the killings this year have occurred on the east side, with nearly half of the violent deaths happening in the city's 4th Police District. Whether you are from Harvard, now for listeners who are outside the Cleveland area, these are the names of the neighborhoods most impacted by the gun violence. Whether you're from Harvard, St. Clair, Buckeye, the West Side, wherever you're from, we have to say it's going to take us as a community to clean our community up, said Jones. If you know anything about these crimes, call 216-25-CRIME. You can remain anonymous and get a cash reward if your tips lead to an arrest. And that is from the article. I will give the Crime Stoppers number again for those of you who are in Cleveland, Ohio, who have connected with me on Twitter or LinkedIn and may know something about this, these crimes that are unsolved. 216-25-CRIME. Of course, you look at your phone, landline, or cell phone and look for the letters and numbers that match CRIME. So that is an overview of the, it's an overview that contains the map of the people who have died from that are victims of the murders as read in the article. If you are online, you can go to 2019 and look at the homicide map with me. I'm enlarging it. And what I want to do, because I always want to honor people who have lost their lives, I'm going to click on a couple of the buttons and I'm going to read the name of the person and where they were found and remind you how you can report it. So I'm looking at a young man who was killed named Talbert Dion Williams. He was killed on April 15th of this year. He was 21 years old. He's Black and male. And the county in Cleveland, Ohio, they use B for Black race. Of course, a lot of people are using African American, and that's just how it's being counted. So if you are in another city and they use A, chances are it's not Asian, it's African American. They probably use AA. Now, he was killed on 931 East 147th Street. in Cleveland, Ohio, District 5. And that particular killing is actually walking distance from where I broadcast from. And his cause of death was being shot. And that's Talbert Dion Williams. Taking a look at the other side of town, much further west, we have a victim named Antonio Dion Parra. And he was killed August 28th, age 30. They're listing his race as Black. And he was killed on West 51st Street, District 2. His homicide was a murder, and he was also shot. Taking a look at another victim, Dewey Walls. He was age 54, and he's a little bit outside of the normal age range or the trend. Race, Black, gender, male. He was killed at 340-21 East 103rd Street. That is District 4, and he was shot also. Going a little bit further east in Cleveland, Ohio, a young man, age 26, named Tavarison, T-A-R-V-A-R-S-I-O-N. No, I'm not trying to be disrespectful. I'm having difficulty with the name. T. Waller. He was killed on September 21st, 2019, age 26. And he was killed also in District 5, the location 898 Alhambra in Cleveland, Ohio. And we'll take a look at something closer to an occurrence closer in the suburban area. Justin Powell. He was killed on June 25th, 2019, only age 20, 17006 South Miles Avenue, and that's District 4. So if you are listening and you live in Cleveland, Ohio, and you're following the title of my show, I want you to go ahead and contact some of these councilmen and ask them how you as a voter, how you as a long life resident of Cleveland, or maybe you just moved here, how can you help them eradicate the gun violence that is occurring in their areas? The article mentioned Bashir Jones. He's from Ward 7. Some of the other names of the councilmen who are connected to these homicides in terms of geography and political management: Kenneth Johnson, Phyllis Cleveland. They are responsible for these boards where we heard some of these horrific crimes occurred. Bashir Jones, Blaine Griffin, Kevin Bishop, Carrie McCormick, Kenneth Johnson, Phyllis Cleveland. And so if you are in the Cleveland area and you want them to do something, let them know that you are unhappy with their attempts. Let your councilman know in Cleveland, Ohio, that you know that there are public health models that can be implemented, and they are not. Previously, they hired Dwayne Deskins to do something about the gun violence, but he resigned in less than a year, and very little has been done. The money from the Department of Justice after the Tamir Rice shooting went to hire more policemen. So that may not be acceptable to you. If you have a grassroots organization and you would like to do something about it, let your councilman know. And I've mentioned that in the past, that articles online by Lisa Rose Rodriguez, you can find her on LinkedIn, about reducing gun violence and gun morbidity mortality. She also has a proposal where she will come and talk to your grassroots organization, and train you in harm reduction models. You need to be trained in harm reduction models so that your organization can see immediate results. The African American men who are at risk will identify themselves at risk and learn better interpersonal conflict skills. And other people are doing this. If you want to contact her, lrrodriguez_mph@yahoo.com, lrrodriguez_mph@yahoo.com. Let her know you heard about her on Victims to Victorious. If you are in the Cleveland, Ohio area and you are in any of those wards I mentioned, and you are fed up with the homicide rate, let your councilman know. They have a general phone number, 216-664-2840, 216-664-2840. And the Cleveland City Council also publishes its fax number. Now, many people don't use fax machines anymore. However, if you are wanting to advocate for a loved one or your organization, I would recommend writing a letter and faxing it with a picture of the deceased person that you are grieving or whose crime, whose murder has not been solved yet. So the Cleveland City Council number is, fax number is 216-664-3837. If you have legal documents or other things that are, you know, would be a little tricky to send as a fax, their snail mail address is Cleveland City Council, 601 Lakeside Avenue, room 220, Cleveland, Ohio, 44114. My name is Angel Fall. You're listening to Victims to Victorious. About 30 seconds or so, we will take a station identification break. You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. Podcasts for this show and others are available. You can go to the blacktalkradionetwork.com and listen to me or listen to other people's archive shows. If you wish to call in after the station identification, the number is 704-802-5056. The title of today's show is Cleveland Killings, Call Your Councilman to Change the Death and Destruction. So we'll be back after the station identification.
Hi, the Black Talk Media Project would like to invite you to become a member of the BTR Community subscription-based social media platform. BTR Community is a platform that was set up for the listening audience of Black Talk Radio Network, the number one independent Black radio network online. For just $24 per year, your subscription gives you access to an interactive space to share information with like-minded people with your privacy guaranteed. Your subscription will go a long way to help us maintain and improve our current media platforms. It will also help provide a budget so that we can begin the task of establishing localized media centers and radio stations across the United States. The best way to show your support and appreciation for what we do here at Black Talk Radio is to subscribe. Help us to help you be informed. Join BTRCommunity.com today.
Is Victims to Victorious. Of course, you can follow me on Air Angel. Now, we began the show discussing some of the statistics going on with Cleveland, Ohio, and the actual locations and deaths of young African American men. In preparing for the show, I know that 71% of the victims in Cleveland, Ohio that we're discussing are African American men, and that's actually higher than the trend throughout the United States. The trend is the homicide victims that are African American men, they average about 51% of all homicides. So East Cleveland, I don't know if it's been annexed yet to the city of Cleveland, but it appears on the map here. If you're following me, I'm revisiting, I'm giving honor to some of the victims of homicide in the Cleveland, Ohio area. On February 5th, 2019, Mohammed Shahin was killed. They're listing his race as white. He was 33 years old. He is in the District 5. He's in District 5, D5. His homicide type is murder, and the cause was shot. Every once in a while, when you read death certificates, which I have done, the cause is unknown. Now, there's a couple of things that are going on. Those are called, that can be a statistical artifact. Sometimes when you are shot, you appear to have a puncture wound, just as if you were stabbed, for instance. But if the bullet goes through and through, the coroner may not be able to determine what has damaged the tissue. All right, so we're looking at another victim. His name is Dion Taylor. He was killed at the beginning of the year. January 12, 2019, at 1201 East 185th Street, Cleveland, Ohio. His homicide type is murder, and the cause was being shot. It is 11:32. We have about 28 minutes more to go here on Victims to Victorious. I want to thank you for tuning in. If you want to call, the number is 704-802-5056. 704-802-5056. So I want to connect the Cleveland, Ohio statistics and trends with the larger trends, because we do have listeners all over the country and also outside of the United States. So here are some more statistics. And we've proven, I just read those names randomly. We have one white male victim, but he is still a gunshot wound victim. So blacks in the United States, and I'm reading from Black Homicide Victimization in the United States from the Violence Policy Center. Blacks in the United States are disproportionately affected by homicide. For the year 2016, and remember, this was published in 2018, and I downloaded it in 2019. For the year 2016, blacks represented 13% of the nation's population, yet accounted for 51% of all homicide victims. The devastation homicide elicits on black teens and adults is a national crisis that should be a top priority for policymakers to address. An important part of ending our nation's gun violence epidemic will involve reducing homicides in the African American community. A little bit later, we're going to talk about trauma spas as a way of addressing the PTSD of the grieving and the a lot of people don't think about the loved ones and the family members who are victimized. We do see them crying on TV. We do see them maybe screaming or yelling and becoming inconsolable at the crime scene, especially in television and movies. But what is going on with the people who survived that have been left behind years and months later? And if time allows, we're going to look at a model in Boston called Trauma Spa. Returning to the Violence Policy Center article, in addition, individuals living in communities where violence is prevalent are at an increased risk for a broad range of negative health and behavior outcomes. An increased understanding of how trauma resulting from community violence influences development, health, and behavior can lead to improvements in the way many social services are delivered, as well as policy changes at the local and federal level. And this is what I'm advocating to listeners. The people who vote in office, they need to know what you think will help your community. Obviously, taking Department of Justice money to hire more policemen is not really helping with the relationship, the adversarial relationship of African-American males and their and the people who police them. It's not helping that. We have not seen a decrease in police shootings since Tamir Rice. We haven't seen a decrease in gun violence against African-American men or between African-American men. So how can this money be used better? Again, if you want your grassroots organization to be trained on identifying men at risk and instituting interpersonal conflict behaviors that resolve conflict instead, resolve conflict peacefully, I urge you to contact the epidemiologist Lisa Rose-Rodriguez, and her email address is lrrodriguez_mph@yahoo.com. We've also looked at much larger programs like Cure Violence that have been instituted in another Midwest city, Chicago. So for Black victims of homicide, returning to the article, like all victims of homicide, guns, usually handguns, are far and away the number one murder tool. Successful efforts to reduce America's Black homicide toll, like America's homicide toll as a whole, must be put a focus on reducing access and exposure to firearms. That's from the Violence Policy Center. Here are some more statistics, and I want to step away from the article and remind you, if you've been following my show since July, is that a white man is most likely to use a gun to kill himself. a gun that has already been housed in the home. The gun might have been there for generations. A white male is most likely to commit suicide with a gun. And in doing so, white men may use a long gun. It's difficult to use a long gun to shoot yourself if you are a woman, for instance, because of how short your arms are. That's a fact. That's not me being funny. I happen to be a short person. But it is a little bit more difficult. To, yes, go right ahead. We have a caller.
Hi. Yes. Sherry Ann Serkin. I'm just calling to listen in, but I wanted to let you guys know that you've got another audience member.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Professor Turpin. We are discussing the homicides in Cleveland, Ohio, and where they are located, who are the victims. We're connecting that to the national data. When you grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, tell the listeners, did you have any, were you ever impacted by a gun violence death in the suburb you lived in?
Well, growing up, no. I mean, I knew about men in my family owning guns or owning hunting rifles. That was actually pretty common in my neighborhood. I grew up in the suburbs, and occasionally you would see, a venison lake or two. But that was something that we always heard about happening in the city. I think the closest I ever came to it is witnessing it while riding in the car with my parents and my brother and seeing the car next door getting shot. We were in the city, and so we grew up thinking that the city was this dangerous place. We didn't grow up thinking that guns could, go off in a home or that people would turn guns on each other, domestic violence. And so that's not something that I saw until I lived in Atlanta and I saw a gun shooting on a MARTA train. That was frightening to me, very frightening. Every once in a while, something that you witness from afar, I heard a domestic incident happen next door when I lived in Columbia Heights during the latter 80s, early 90s in D.C., but no, it's to me, gun violence can happen anywhere. We now know that. But growing up in Cleveland, Ohio, it's almost as if the way that the press would tell you gun violence didn't happen in the suburbs. But now that I know a bit more about Bedford Heights, and now that I know about the history of the mafia in the neighborhood where I grew up, I now realize that there was a lot of violence. I lived not too far from a landfill where apparently that was a de facto burial ground for the local mafia, with the Cheesy family, if I'm not mistaken. But it always seemed to be something that was from afar. You don't find these things out until you become an adult. At least that's the way it was for me growing up in the 70s and in the lower 80s. I'm Gen X. So, yeah, that's been pretty much my experience. Have I ever seen a gun? Yes. Have I ever used a gun? A little shooting stand. So that was in Georgia where, it was legal. And that was it, like a shooting gallery. That's it. When I think of guns, I don't think of it as something that I have to have. And so, I grew up politically on NRA side, the African American who believed that you should be able to own a gun as long as you didn't break the law. I've had a change of heart after seeing what can happen when you have people who are mentally ill or who have anger issues, you know, or because of domestic violence. You have men and women and children who pick up guns and use them. And so, I don't know, I just kind of feel as though people are faster to pick up a gun than to just ball up a fist and go to town. That's pretty much the way I see it.
Well, thank you, Sherry, for joining in. We have a little more than 15 minutes to go. And because of your call a few weeks ago, I want to remind the listeners that we actually did a show about the intersection of gun violence and conjugal partner violence. The show was called Battered Women and Bullets, When Conjugal Violence Kills. It has been archived and uploaded to the website by Scotty. So you can go to Black Talk Radio Network, and you can actually search, you can click the tab, Victims to Victorious. You can also search by the name of the show, or the name of that episode, which is called Battered Women and Bullets, When Conjugal Violence Kills. And I'm just going to review a little bit, since Professor Turpin had called in and made a suggestion last week. We did discuss the way guns are used to threaten a woman, usually by a man. And we discussed the fact that the data is mixed as to whether or not a woman who is armed can defend herself in a domestic violence situation. We also listed the states, and I know that Sherry used to live in one of them. Connecticut is a state where your weapons are confiscated if you have domestic violence charges. I was actually in court one day, and there was a man that Sherry and I were to refer to as a swamp Yankee. He was over 60. He was a white male rural person from Connecticut. But swamp Yankee, if you look in the Urban Dictionary, it actually has more than one definition. A lot of the professors at the University of Connecticut are swamp Yankees. They have PhDs. They have never paid a mortgage on their home since George Washington was president, and that's the same house they've been living in. That would be one example. But he was required to turn over his weapons. The NRA and other people have a spin that the police are coming house to house and removing weapons. And we actually found with the research, and I can make that available, that there are very few states where the sheriff or the local authorities actually do bang on your door and remove the weapons. Most of the states it's an order for you to turn them in. But there are a few states that differ in something that was very interesting, and that is confiscating the gun only described by the victim or confiscating all guns. There was a discrepancy, I shouldn't say, it was a differential in which states would do that. So I want to thank Professor Turpin for calling in and giving us that idea for a show. And that show was Battered Women and Bullets, When Conjugal Violence Kills. It's still available on the website at blacktalkradionetwork.com. And you can post a comment there. And while you're there, you can also donate to the Black Talk Media Project. There's a donation button there. And we're trying to raise $6,700. And $95. Do you have any more to share for the listeners, Sherry?
Yeah, I am one of those people who experience, gun violence in a conjugal relationship. I had a boyfriend during my early 20s who decided to pull a weapon on me while we were in bed to compel me to stay. And when I wanted to leave. And I had a boyfriend here in the D.C. area who attempted to rape me before I left. And after my first year of graduate school, told a mutual friend that he had purchased a gun. And so I made it a point of not being in contact with him. And he unfortunately has popped up recently in my purview, and that's been a concern to me. And so to me, it's almost as if, you know, if you have an ex, whether you have an ex-husband, ex-wife, ex-boyfriend, ex-girlfriend, and this goes across sexual orientation lines, but there is the intersection of domestic violence coming from men who believe that they own women. And so you mix that with the politics of gun ownership, and you can have a pretty violent situation. You mix that in with rape culture. You have yet another element, so that's something to consider.
For the listeners, could you explain that term you just used, rape culture?
Rape culture, you know, where rape, coerced sex, or refusing to acknowledge or respect consent has been normalized through popular culture, through religious institutions, through state institutions, through law, through tradition, through familial teaching, through other forms of the belief that men own women and girls' bodies. An example of that would be T.I. getting on a podcast and two black women laughing about how he owns his daughter's body, go so far as to disclose publicly the results of her exam by the GYN, going so far as to use his money and influence to encourage the doctor, who should be respecting federal law and recognizing domestic abuse and rape culture, to disclose the results of her GYN test. And so rape culture is not just the act of rape, not just rape through alcohol, but other forms of coercion. If a woman or a girl does not have the right to say yes or no, that is rape culture. That's also patriarchy and misogyny. Is it possible for men to be victims under rape culture? Absolutely. And so that is exactly why I do not believe that sex or relationships or relationship terms should be done under any sort of coercion, whether it be social coercion, whether it be emotional coercion or physical coercion or otherwise, or work coercion.
So that takes us to, and I really am grateful for Professor Turpin calling in, and the radio show is not just about me. I need to hear from the audience. We began the show talking about homicides in Cleveland, Ohio. We had a bit of a local focus, and Professor Turpin is attaching to the subjects we had previously, the show last week. So the National Crime Survey is a self-report survey in which interviewed persons are asked about the number of characteristics of victimization, and this means they're looking at non-fatal violent crimes, including rape or assault. And there is an article on firearm violence. If you are following me, it's on the Bureau of Justice statistics and how often those weapons are used in rape. So firearm injury, firearms can be used simply as a threat. And they're all, we all seen television shows where someone purports to have a weapon and they don't, by reaching in their pocket or their purse. So if you want to know more about how guns are used in sexual assault, go to the bgs.gov/index and you will see articles on that. The latest data on the Bureau of Justice Statistics was collected in 2011. So there are really good statistics for you to see. And we also, Professor Turpin, we also gave out a national hotline number for domestic violence victims. And it's really important. I heard you talk about the fact that the violence appears. The violence can be non-physical. It can be mental. It can be denial of sex. It can be denial of monetary benefits, threatening to turn off utilities, threatening pets. It comes out in lots of permutations. I want to give that number, and then I want to go back to some of the larger statistics that connect to Cleveland, Ohio, on African-American male victimization and these cities where these homicides occur. So if you are listening to Dr. Turpin's comment, you can go to thehotline.org, and you can also call 1-800-799-7233. This is the National Domestic Violence Hotline, and there is also one in Spanish, en español. It's at 1-800-7, the TDY is 1-800-787-3224. And in Espanol, I'm trying to get the number up. Let's see what the number is. Well, the website translates in Spanish, but they will ask you when you call if you speak Spanish. So the 1-800-799-7233 is the TDY. And if you speak Spanish, you can call 1-800-787-3224. I'm trying to say in Spanish, 1-800-787-87. Tres, dos, dos, cuatro. So thank you for calling, Sherry. And I am going to give a few more of the statistics on the epidemic of Black homicide victimization. Do you have any more comments for the listeners?
No, I'm just going to sit here and listen.
Well, I want to thank you again for your support. And I know you write about rape culture. Perhaps we can do a show with you in the future where we take a look at those statistics I mentioned about women who are sexually assaulted by a conjugal partner or stranger when a gun is used. So returning to the tighter theme and statistics of today's show, for homicides in which a weapon was used, and we're looking at the article from Violence Policy Center, 87% of Black victims, which is 6,505 out of 7,442, were shot and killed with guns. So that means that it's the number one way we are dying in a violent act to be shot by a handgun. Of these 66%, 4,319 victims were killed with handguns. I returned to the article, but of course I knew that. There were 540 victims killed with knives or other cutting instruments. 193 victims were killed by bodily force, and 117 victims were killed by a blunt object. In comparison, white victims, 67% of white victims and 78% of victims of all races were killed with guns. For homicides in which the victim-to-offender relationship could be identified, and I am expounding on my own paradigm here, this is one of the things that A Cure Violence advocates for. Lisa Rose Rodriguez, an epidemiologist who's interested in teaching harm reduction, she is advocating for the fact that most African-American men are killed by a person that they actually do know. It's a friend or an acquaintance. The Institute for Community Research in Hartford does very good research on social networks and what things that happen in social networks, crimes, drug use, etc. So for homicides in which the victim-to-offender relationship can be identified, 75% of Black victims were killed by someone they knew. 750 victims were killed by strangers. The circumstances. For homicides in which the circumstances could be identified, 71% were not related to the commission of any other felony. And what's important here is in curing this as a public health phenomenon, if there isn't a violent offense occurring, you're not being robbed, your house isn't being broken into, your car isn't being stolen, this is an interpersonal conflict that has arisen to the level where one person decides to end the conflict, he's going to end someone else's life. Now, we have only about 2 minutes to go, and I know Professor Turpin is listening, and she is a feminist who advocates for women all over the world. And I want to turn the listeners on very quickly to the spas, the trauma spas that have been started in Boston, Massachusetts. Now, the trauma spa article can be found by typing in trauma spa in the Google search engine in Boston. And the trauma spa is a pilot set for female survivors of gun violence. We have only about a minute left, but I do want the listeners to know that there is such a thing as a trauma spa, and it is designed to help women heal from PTSD. It was founded by Mary Franklin, the creator of Women Survivor of Homicide, and it was designed as a 12-week pilot program. It started in Dorchester, Massachusetts. If you're not familiar with the eastern part of the United States, Dorchester, Massachusetts, Roxbury, these are all places that are actually part of Boston or near Boston, and Boston has a high Black-on-Black crime rate. So I want to point you to the article. We'll talk about the article a little bit more, or you can follow me on air Twitter. But the pilot is partly designed to link women with mental health resources and clinicians at the Boston Medical Center. And we've spoken earlier in some of the other episodes about the fact that when someone is shot, your trauma doesn't end right there. And this has a rippling effect or a domino effect. So visit the article on the Boston Herald website. And perhaps next week we can go into more about the after effects, the PTSD of victims who survived being shot, and the PTSD of their family members and loved ones. I want to thank Professor Turpin for calling in, Scotty Reed, my sound engineer, those of you who follow me on Twitter. The podcast will be up in a couple of hours. I am On Air Angel on Twitter, and you've been listening to Victims to Victorious.